Dear Asian Girl, for Asian girls, by Asian girls.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Dear Asian Girl. I'm one of your co-hosts, Eden. I am 21 years old, a recent graduate who now works in the grassroots sector, and I'm based in London in the UK. And joining me is...
Hi, everyone. My name's Meghna. I'm 19 years old. I go to UCLA. I'm a second year right now. I'm Indian American, and I am a double majoring in public affairs and business econ, and I'm super excited for today's episode.
Hi, everyone. My name is Abigail. As always, I am 22. I am based in Seattle, and I am currently a senior at the University of Washington. And today on the show, we have a very exciting guest. As you know, season 7 has all been all about the arts, and how could we talk about arts without looks and therefore fashion? So please welcome to the show Olivia Kim. Could you please introduce yourself for us?
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for having me. It's so lovely to meet you all. I'm Olivia Kim. I am our SVP of Creative Merchandising here at Nordstrom. I'm based in Seattle, but originally a born and raised New Yorker. I'm a mom, I'm a wife, I'm a daughter, and I'm a Korean American. I am a first generation. And it's something that really resonates with me. And it's something that has constantly been a part of my work, constantly been a part of who I am, and whether I acknowledged it or not growing up as a kid. But it certainly is today. Thanks so much for having me.
Obsessed. Love your intro. And also big woots in the chat for Korean Americans today.
Woo-hoo.
Woo! Thank you guys, Meghna and Eden. Allies.
Always. Korean American ally, all the way from the UK.
Oh, wait, yeah. Not that I forgot you are from the UK. Anyway. When we're going to just kind of start rolling into it, you kind of talked about it briefly when you said it about acknowledging it when you were younger. I'm curious, what was your relationship with being Asian as a child?
I mean, I think it's such an interesting question, and I wonder if my response resonates with so many other people of my generation. I'm quite older than all three of you, just for those who've shared their ages. I'm 46. I'll be 47 this year. I'm super excited about growing older. I know that it's something that, as women, it's definitely, you know, something that people grapple with, but I am excited about it. But growing up Asian in the 80s, late 70s, early 80s, you know, we just didn't see a lot of people like me. You know, I grew up in New Jersey and New York. I didn't have a lot of Asian friends. So the only Asian people that I really saw were my own family. I have a sister that's just a year younger than me. But, you know, it was almost like a lack of acknowledgement, because I think so many people that were of my parents' age, you know, when they immigrated, it wasn't about immigrating and being proud of who you are. It was immigrating and acclimating. And so much of what my parents did was, you know, try to have my sister and I fit in every way possible. Not only from learning the language and them trying to speak the language to us at home, but like I remember my mom learning how to try to cook cheesecake and like cheeseburger hamburger helper. And she learned how to make lasagna and, you know, like all these like very, very stereotypical American foods, especially as we got older, right? Especially like as friends would come over or we would go to a friend's house and, you know, I'd be like, Mom, guess what? Like, I was at my Jewish friend's house, and they have this thing called brisket. You know, and it's like, you know, very non-traditional Korean foods. And then she'd be like, okay, let me figure out how to make a brisket. So, you know, that sort of acknowledgement at a young age of kind of not acknowledging it, it's super interesting. And then especially not having other Koreans or Asian Americans around you to kind of validate, you know, who you are. It was probably not until I got to college where I started to get really, really excited about being Asian and being Korean in particular. I went to NYU, and there were just, like, so many Asians all around, which is awesome. Yeah, but then and then, you know, as I've gotten older and older, like, I realize how much of being Korean, being Korean American, being, you know, a daughter of a Korean American immigrant family has very subconsciously and unknowingly, like, been infused into my life.
No, thank you for sharing all of that. That's so wonderful. I just wanted to say, like, to some of the things that you just mentioned, I'm also first gen. So I also immigrated from India with my family when I was around, like, 3 years old. So I guess, like, the politically correct term is 1.5 generation. It's, like, a little bit nuanced. But I wonder if there's, like, something with immigrant families and cheesecake, because when you said that, I immediately flashed back to the fact that my dad has been obsessed with making cheesecake recently. He literally just helped me make a cheesecake for my best friend's birthday. Her birthday is tomorrow. Shout out to my best friend. She's turning 20. I love her so much.
Awesome.
But he literally, like, helped me make a cheesecake for her birthday. So I'm like, is that, like, just an immigrant thing?
Crumbs and everything on the bottom.
Yeah, we use Nilla wafers and graham crackers to make the crust, and then Philadelphia cream cheese for the the cheese. I don't know. I just thought of that.
I feel like you can't. I mean, there's, like, organic cream cheeses out there, but I feel like if you're gonna make, like, a true cheesecake, it has to be Philadelphia 100%.
It was
sure.
So fun to make. But to your point about how, like, being Korean, being Asian, like, affected your childhood growing up, we also wanted to ask you how that affected your work and your creative work specifically, like, with fashion. So we wanted to ask, how does being part of the Asian diaspora, how does being a first generation immigrant, how does that part of your identity and culture influence how you interact with your creative world? And how does that, I guess, inform your fashion choices?
That's a big question. I'd say, you know, I'm super lucky that my mom is a super creative person. She was an art student in college before she immigrated. She's very, very much, like, she can figure things out with her hands. Like, you know, my mom and I joke about the fact that, you know, I'm kind of Lady MacGyver. I can kind of figure everything out without following instructions. And I've definitely learned a lot of that from her. I think that's really unique for a lot of Asian Americans, particularly of her generation, right? I think so many of those immigrants, you know, they came either to the States or wherever they immigrated into. And it was really about, you know, having children and having those children, like, live this American dream and be successful. And be successful meant, like, being a doctor or being a lawyer, you know, going to do these very ambitious jobs that have nothing to do with creativity. And so I'm really lucky that my mom really sought out any opportunity for us to explore lots of different things. So we grew up playing lots of sports and lots of musical instruments. We took art classes. We did gymnastics. We did tennis and soccer. And, you know, we kind of did it all. And my mom never pushed us to be any one type of person, right? Or any one type of job, or go do, like, this specific thing at this specific university and then go have this type of job with this type of house. And I think a lot of that really has stuck with me in terms of how I navigate through the world and through my own job. You know, I really am constantly looking for things off the beaten path. You know, I think things that are very mainstream or things that are more commercial to me, while I can appreciate them and I understand, like, the efficiency of things like that, it doesn't necessarily, like, make me hum. And I think I get a lot of that from her. And my creative choices around fashion have also been really instilled by my mom. My mom has always really loved window shopping, I guess is what you call it, like browsing, right? And so whenever I was sick from school or, you know, ever we had time off, you know, we would just go to the mall. We spent a lot of time just going to the mall and walking around. And I think part of, you know, again, that sort of immigrant mentality about wanting to provide the best opportunities for your children also meant providing the best clothes or as much as they could afford, right? Like giving the best that they could to their kids. So we always had, like, really nice clothes, you know, and at that time it was like Benetton and Esprit and Genera and brands like that. And so I really appreciated fashion from a young age, especially because those brands had such visual, they had such visual cues, right? You think about like the catalog and the imagery, the shopping bag, those store experiences. That's always been such a huge part of my retail experience. And so when I think about what I do today, so much of that is nostalgically taken from then. And growing up, I didn't realize that you could have a job. Like, I didn't know that retail or fashion was a job other than being a fashion designer, you know, and I'm not an artist, right? Like, I can't draw. I certainly can't sew or drape. And so I, you know, and I don't think that anybody was ever like, well, you could be the SVP of creative merchandising. And like, what the hell does that even mean? You know what I mean? Like, even today, my mom thinks I work in the store, which I love, right? Like, because I love being in our store. Like, I love listening to people shopping and helping people and customers in our stores. But, you know, I think it's so interesting now how much visibility and how much exposure we have to so many different types of jobs that are out there versus what I knew growing up. Mm. So I don't know if that answers your question, Magna, because it was a big one. So if I didn't, you can ask me again.
No, you're so fine. I think you definitely answered the question. I think like there wasn't like one specific answer we were looking for. It's just whatever came to mind. And that was a beautiful answer. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And I mean, I've always loved clothes. Like I've always loved putting outfits together. I would write them down in my little like little Twin Stars notebook, what I wore every single day. And so like I would just like go back in and be like, okay, well, I wore that outfit yesterday and those socks yesterday and this shoe like last week. I would write all of it down. Mm-hmm. So I guess I've always liked putting outfits together. But now, like for my real job, I like putting experiences together. Like I like creating moments for customers to come in and feel excited by what we have to offer, not just, you know, dressing mannequins or dressing myself.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for sharing that. Sorry. Redo.
No, I was just gonna really like Eden, I would love to ask for you to ask the next question. I'm just gonna tap in really quick to say, like, as a person who grew up in Washington, the experience of visiting a department store is really, really fun. I think I remember when I was younger being able to visit my mom like at her job, and then afterwards she's like, okay, I have to get something at Nordstrom or something, and being able to come with her and just like it feels like a experience which just doesn't feel as common anymore, or like a more from a era in the past, like in this way where there's like a beauty to this sense of like curation that you enter this space, and that a lot of intent was designed for it. And also like in my brain as a kid, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm like playing a little, I'm like a, what's the word? There's like this one storybook character of like this girl who loves pink and like lives
Pink-alicious?
In like a place, not her, but that's another one. I think it's her name's like, I think it's like Fancy Nancy, but like,
I got so excited.
Something like that. Just like this idea of being like, it feels like for if you're a very specific brand of kid, like you're entering a candy store when you enter a department store, which is like.
Wait, that's so funny, Abby. It's so funny because it was the exact opposite for me. Oh my gosh, I'm going to out myself right now. But I never had like the patience for shopping as a little kid. Like my mom would always like she was super into clothes, so she would always take her time going through the racks and trying things on. I was such an impatient little kid. Literally, all I remember doing in department stores was going into the rack of clothing and sitting in that little space in the middle and just hanging out and pretending I was in my own secret world. Now that I think about it, that's so weird. But that's literally has been my experience as a kid.
I think that's so normal. I still see kids going into clothes and hiding under there. It's fun. Yeah.
But I will say, I have matured, I have grown up, and I totally understand what you mean now about like the department store experience. Again, I'm going to expose myself real quick. I was reading this article that you were talking about, or I was reading this article that you were featured in, Olivia, and I remember one part you were saying like there's like a certain scent and there's a certain like aura when you walk into a department store. Mm-hmm. And I was like, that clicked in my mind. I'm like, that's so true. There is. Like, I remember walking to Hollister and just being like, this is my space. Like, oh my gosh, I'm so excited right now.
Oh my God. Yeah, so like for you, it was Hollister. For me, it was a spray, which I don't, you know, I don't know if that many, you know, 20-year-olds know what a spray is, but I think we all have that, right? And I think that there is something about retail that is so incredibly sensory, right? Like you can remember a smell, you can remember a feeling, you can remember something you saw, whether you liked it or not, or whether you wanted to hide underneath all those clothes.
Yeah. I love that we're talking
about... And my daughter's obsessed with Pink Delicious, and it's so funny you bring that up.
I love that we're talking about kind of our relationships with our mothers, I guess, and these cool memories that we have with our mothers, because here at Dear Asian Girl, we've been thinking a lot about like generations and generationalism and intergenerationalism and what gets passed down. So I really love that, Olivia, you've talked about a really positive relationship that you have with your mum that maybe others in your generation maybe can't share. I know my parents had a complicated relationship with their parents, as much as they obviously loved them. And I know a lot of people still, like around more of our age, still have really complicated relationships with their parents now. And I think that is a testament to how things get passed down and how things affect people across generations, like through the same family line. So I'm really happy to hear that you've had a really positive experience. So to completely put a damper on that, knowing that you're an Asian woman, like double whammy in the fashion industry, which isn't an industry that's always been very open. And still, I mean, there are huge limitations when it comes to any kind of industry that's very like material, very like visual. There are always barriers to people who are other or different. Can you talk a little bit about what it's been like coming into the, well, what it was like when you first entered the industry and what it's been like to kind of build a name for yourself as you have now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I've had such an incredible community of people that I've grown up with. And when we started working in fashion, we were all, you know, kids coming out of NYU that came from different backgrounds that looked different and were different. And I think so much of that was around the timing, right? So I'd say I first really started getting into fashion probably like the late 90s, early 2000s in New York. I opened a store with some friends. And it was in the Lower East Side, which at that time was still predominantly very heavily Orthodox Jewish people living there. It wasn't anything like what New York's Lower East Side is now, which is like bars and clubs and cool hotels. It was pretty scary back then, but we were all doing something new. And I think the camaraderie around this like very youthful irreverence, trying to do something new that hadn't been done before, because there wasn't a playbook. There was nobody to say, hey, you're doing that wrong, or hey, that's not the way we do it, or you don't look like the people that have done something of that kind before. So there was, it was almost sort of like an untouched or uncharted territory. And in that sense, you know, I felt like it was a really safe way in which nobody could bring any amount of attention to the fact that, you know, I was Asian or, you know, not of, you know, not looking like everybody else. I'd say then even as my career has further progressed, even to coming at Nordstrom, I've had some really incredible advocates. And I think that's so important, right, is having people who can support you and see and help share a vision that you have. And I think if it wasn't for those people, it can be really, really hard. But it's kind of like anything, right? Where you need friends, you need supporters, you need advocates, you need allies around you at all times to be successful, because it's really hard to be a singular voice, right? It's hard to sort of say like, hey, I want to do this on my own. I have this idea. An idea is just an idea until actually, you know, you've got a group of people around that can actually help materialize something like that. So, you know, I met Pete Nordstrom in New York in 2013 And he really was a catalyst for me. You know, he really admired the work that I had been doing at opening ceremony. He really admired the community of friends and collaborators that we had built. And he wanted a part of that, right? He was like, how do you bring some of that to Nordstrom? Mm-hmm. We're so vanilla. You know, they called their stores pancakes because they were flat, right? Like literally and philosophically, right? For at that time. And he was like, how do you bring some of that culture and grit and color and, you know, community and friends, all that stuff? He's like, we want that. But it took somebody like him to be the catalyst. And I think that if he hadn't been able to articulate himself in that way, I would never have left New York. I wouldn't have come to, you know, a department store like Nordstrom. It wasn't something that I grew up with. Like, I love the story, Abby, about you and your mom, you know, because especially if you're from Seattle, right? Nordstrom is such a huge part of growing up, you know, like there's so many stories that we have of customers who've bought their first shoes here. They bought their first prom dress here. They, you know, they bought their first Chanel lipstick or whatever they bought. And they come with their mom and they come with their grandmother and, or they eat at the cafe every Friday, whatever they do. Like, there's so many traditions, that happen here, but I didn't have that with Nordstrom growing up, you know, but meeting somebody like Pete was really, really eye-opening and really inspiring. Like, I wanted that platform, right? I wanted the platform that I couldn't get, you know, working for a small niche retailer. But like, what could you imagine, like all the color you could bring to on a national scale? And for somebody who was like, come and be you, it's pretty powerful.
Wow. That was so nice. Love that. That's, yeah, we could all use just, I think it's so important to be able to advocate for yourself and be like, mm-hmm. I believe in me. But the reality is, it can be, like you said, like, it can be exhausting to do that on your own mm-hmm. constantly. So that's such a beautiful story to hear. Meghna?
Yeah, and I just wanted to, I guess, like, really applaud you for making that career change, because, like, whenever, I mean, I remember when I was first thinking about, like, what is, like, a professional career, what is, like, a professional journey, it always seemed like such a straight line to me. I'm like, you choose a job and you follow it through to the end of your life or, like, to retirement, and then you're just done, I guess. But, like, through these past few years, I've been learning that that's not how, like, it actually works. It's not how life works. Like, people are constantly learning and changing and having new interests, new passions, and new opportunities opening up for them, and people take them. And sometimes it's like a huge change. Sometimes it's like a subtle change, but like, no one sticks to the same thing like forever. But that always seemed like such a scary thing to me, because it's like, you establish yourself and you get comfortable, but then a new opportunity comes your way and you're like, this could be super exciting and this could go really great, but could also not go super great. So I just wanted to say, like, that's amazing that you were able to make that change and go all the way from New York to Seattle to start essentially this new career and build yourself back up. That's really amazing.
Oh, thanks so much for acknowledging that. I mean, it, and just hearing you say that, it's, I think you make me sound more brave than I am. You know, but
no, I'm sure I'm underselling you, I'm sure.
I mean, it is scary. I think you're absolutely right. Like, you just nailed it on the head, is that careers and life is not this linear path. And I think people who have the most interesting, like, retrospective on their lives are the people who have, like, zigzagged and sidewinded and, you know, kind of gone forwards and back. And then have had to, you know, be courageous and be brave, or like take a huge pay cut, or, you know, go do something that feels wildly different. I mean, I didn't think that I was going to be out in the Pacific Northwest this long. I was like, I'm going to go for 2 years. I'm going to put a big corporate company on my resume, and I'm going to come back to New York and get like a really cool job, right? Because then people will take me seriously, because I've worked for, you know, a publicly traded company on the stock market. I was like, that's what I'm gonna do. And here I am, like, still 11 years later, so incredibly grateful and feeling so privileged for the job that I have and the work that I get to do. But there is, you know, I feel like an obligation to continue to pass that on, right? I feel an obligation to continue to, like, what Pete did for me, how do I continue to create those opportunities or be a catalyst for somebody? In a way that I felt that. But I honestly never thought that I'd be here this long.
I mean, as a West Coast resident, I can say this. To hear you be like, yeah, I'm going to move back. I understand why you would.
But I think that there's something very, I don't know, you know, it really does become about the community, right? And the people that I work with. I think one of the questions you asked me was like, what inspires you or who inspires you? I'm like, every day I'm inspired by the people that I get to work with here. Because a lot of the people I thought were like, they're not going to be cool. They're not going to be creative. They're not going to be like, I'm in Seattle, Washington. You know what I mean? But they've turned out to be so smart, so brilliant, so collaborative. They've turned out to be really good humans and great friends. And I'm so incredibly lucky that they want to work with me. You know what I mean? And that's why, I mean, like you think about even your guys' community. I've also done a little bit of research on all of you, but just like the community that you've built and this podcast and the guests that you brought on, it's incredible, right? And that's sort of why you do it. It's not because it's like you get to put a big star under the word I, you know, it's about a we, it's about it, all of you guys collectively.
Okay, I love that word.
Olivia, sorry.
We're too in sync.
I'm so sorry.
We're too in sync.
This is our brands right now.
Yeah, literally across the oceans.
But I wanted to say really quickly, Olivia, thank you for giving every Asian creative person who's in the PNW hope and a reminder that they're not. It's not just a place to escape. Because I think that a lot of Asian creatives who I, you know, grow up around, who like live in Seattle, live in the PNW, they're like, then I'm going to move to LA. Then I'm going to move to New York.
Really?
So. Mm. Hope in my heart too.
I feel that as someone who lives just outside of West London. For all my UK listeners, that is Slough. I'm talking about Slough, which I'm getting the vibes that it's giving Pacific Northwest. So yeah, I relate to that on like a cellular level. But yeah, I just wanted to say that I'm really loving how much we're talking about community and the importance of the people that we surround ourselves with and how they can be like a daily form of inspiration for us. Because I currently work in the – I'm between jobs, but I work in the grassroots sector. So I'm all about working with like-minded and also not like-minded people. But it's all about working in community with others and not just working alone. I think so much of living here in the West has taught me like individualism and like how to like fend for yourself and how to be really selfish and like carve out your own path with like no heed to how that affects other people. And so much of healing my relationship to my like cultural background and my ethnicity has been going back to my like ancestral line and how much they have always valued community and family and honoring ancestry and honoring culture and honoring the community that's around you. Because I think so much that is wrong in this world, especially in like the hyper-capitalistic systems we have here in the West, so much of what is wrong with them is just how selfish people can be and how much they are only thinking about themselves or people who look like them and who lead lives like them. And so it means they're mistreating people who might be different to them and the earth in the process. But yeah, I love that we're talking about community because I think it harks back to what you said in your interview with 10 magazine, I think it was, where you talk about how you love fashion, not because of the clothes, although you love the clothes too, but because of the people that are behind the clothes. So I'm wondering if you could talk a bit more about what you mean by that. And I mean, that's kind of the episode that the episode title we sort of brainstormed for this is more than material. Like what is fashion more than material?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, fashion more than material, I love clothes, right? Like I love shopping. I think I love buying new things. But more so I'm interested in like the sociology and the psychology of how those things got to be there and why those things were even thought about or developed or made. I mean, part of what I love the most about what I get to do and retail in general is like, I'm so interested in the psychology of how people like think and want to buy something or think that that looks good on them. And when you think about fashion designers, I mean, they're artists, right? They've got a vision in their head that comes to life through fabric. And that's so incredible. And then somebody goes and puts that garment on and they feel a certain way, whether they're feeling the translation of the way the designer wanted it to be or whether they interpret that and it gives them this whole other persona. That shit's powerful. Do you know what I mean? And it's cool and it's creative. And I'm interested in the why. Like, I ask a lot of questions. I'm constantly like, okay, but then why this? And then what happened? And then how come? And then why? And then can you tell me again? I'm like one of the people that likes to ask a lot of questions. But that is, you know, one of the things that I love the most about fashion and fashion designers is really trying to get underneath the skin of who they are as people. Like, what influenced them to make that? Is there something in their ancestry or there's something in nostalgia or something in their past that they're trying to retell? What's the story that they want people to hear or feel? I love that kind of stuff.
Oh, love that. I think that's so, I love how much you kind of emphasize the story of things. Look, I'm as a sociology major.
What's that sociology?
I think that why is so important. Not yet. Haven't gotten it quite yet. Almost there. But it really is so important. And I think that when we're able to view things, especially physical things, with more depth than being like, oh, this is an object. Like, what is the story of this object? Because so many things have a history to it. Like, whether it is, oh, this style is reminiscent actually of a traditional clothing from this culture, and this is the history of why that is there. And what does that mean when you actually put it on? Like, I think especially more recently with the prevalence of like these hyper like quick trends that exist where people are like super into it for briefly. Like, I know people were talking about like mob wife for a second, right? Yeah, and it's like they're by these quick like labeling of trends as like these pop words, it removes so much of the history and the why about when you're wearing it. Like, are you wearing that because you're feeling like it's trendy? Are you like, and I think I can't deny, I'm sure someone out there is doing mob wife, but it's like that clothing has a meaning to it, not necessarily just even by history, but by like there's been so much work which has happened for you to be wearing that on your body. And to think that you are separated from that world and that system is crazy. Not to sound like the Devil Wears Prada, but like, it's kind of true. Like, a lot of minds are behind that work. And so appreciate the work that you're doing to be a part of those minds.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's so true, right? There's so much that goes into, you know, a sweater arriving and sitting on the floor of a department store. There is so much. It's wild.
No, I also wanted to add on to that conversation, because when you were describing like how you ask all these questions about why someone produces a piece of an article of clothing or a fashion design, like the way you articulated yourself, it made me think of like how this overarching theme of art in general is like ingrained in this idea of self-expression and like taking something that's within yourself and putting it out into the world for other people to, I guess, interpret and enjoy. And I guess just put like self-reflect on, like other people reflecting on your work and resonating with your work. And I wanted to ask, from all these questions that you ask, from looking at all these different types of designs, all these different types of clothes, how have you developed your own like personal sense of style, and like what has informed and influenced your, I guess, worldview of fashion?
Yeah. I'm pretty, like, my sense of style, I think, is pretty predictable. I kind of have a kit of parts, so to say. You know, obviously I've got like special things, right? Like if you go to an event or something, and I love those things, but like on a day-to-day basis, I my friends have called me Smurfette. Like, literally, if you look at my closet, you know, like, do you guys know who Smurfette is?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. Okay. So there's, like, a video of her once where she's, like, opening up her closet door, and it's just, like, white dress with those white pumps at the bottom, right? My closet is kind of like that. It's, like, black skirts with white shirts and either, like, a black or a gray sweater. It's pretty predictable. And I love the idea of uniform dressing because you don't have to think so much about it. But part of it is also, like, I like the way I look in just that very simple it's easy, right? It's easy for me. I love, like, and some of my black skirts are really big and poofy and very three-dimensional and sculptural, and I have a hard time sitting in the car with them. And some of them are just very simple. But I love the fact that at the end of the day, no matter what, fashion should be something that you feel good in, right? That for whatever it is that you're doing. I also move around a lot. I'm like super high energy, so I can't sit still. Like, I do not have like a desk job where I just sit here and type away. I'm constantly walking around and moving around, and I like to move quick. So I have to be comfortable. But then I also, you know, I do have meetings, you know, where I am sitting with executive, you know, leaders where I have to also be professional. So I think it's really important to also, like, know when you can flex and pivot. You know, sometimes my skirts are a little bit more conservative, and sometimes they can be, like, really wackadoodle and wild, which I love. But again, you know, I think it is important for people to always feel really confident in what they're wearing. Because it is a reflection of who you are, but also understand that, like you will get judged by what you wear. Do you know what I mean? Like, let's have no, like, misconceived notions about that. We get judged by the way we look every single day, like it or not. And so no matter what, like, I hope you're all feeling really good about how you're showing up. You know, like, that's the most important. Like, who cares what other people think? As long as you feel really good about it, you feel comfortable, you can do what you need to do. And it brings you a sense of confidence. That, to me, means, like, you've got great style.
I love that. That just kind of makes me think about, like, baby me, like indulging in my own, like, sense of, like, artistic expression. And, like, so context a little bit. I really love creative writing. It's something that I've been doing my whole life. I started when I was, like, 6 years old. And I just, like, the story arc of, like, me as a creative writer, like, when I was little, I would share my stories with everyone, and I never, like, cared what anyone else thought. I was always like, oh my gosh, read this. I wrote this. Do you like it? Like, look at the pretty colors. Like, they're all different color fonts, and I have, like, little clip art illustrations, and I would be so proud of myself. And then going to, like, adolescence, being like, okay, wait, my writing is terrible. I never want anyone to read this ever. I won't ever show my stories ever. And then kind of down back to, like, this coming full circle to know, like, I'm confident in what I've written. I've put myself into this piece of art. I really, like, I poured my heart into this, and I think that it'll reach the right people and it'll resonate with the right people. And that's really all that matters. As long as there's that one person who, like, feels like they can relate to that piece of art that I just created, or feels like they, like, it touches their soul. Like, that's all that really matters at the end of the day. Like, I don't need, like, world renown in order to consider myself, like, a successful writer. I think success to me is just, like, being able to touch another person and be able to uplift them and make them happy with what I've created.
I love that. Love that. Love that. Mm. You articulated that so well. Like a true creative writer. I love that.
So sweet. I love how much of healing our relationship with ourselves is just about healing our relationship to our inner child and going back to things that we loved and we embraced about ourselves when we were young, before, like, the world set in on us. I just wanted to bring in, this is kind of a mini tangent, but I recently saw a take that was saying how we've, like, mentioned trends a couple of times in this episode so far. And the take was that trends are becoming so, so microscopic that they're moving so fast that nothing is a trend anymore. And that means, because all these trends are, like, running almost at the same time, it means that trends don't exist. And so people are just wearing whatever they want at any time. So Olivia, I just wanted to kind of, like, what your opinion is on that. And, like, if you've observed that happening.
I love that. You know, one of the teams that I work with here is our culture and trend team, our forecasting team, right? So we spend a lot of time talking about trends. We spend a lot of time predicting and sort of intaking the cultural. Yeah, it's, I mean, those people are like wicked smart. Do you know what I mean? Because they're basically looking at everything and then trying to find the common denominators to predict trends for years out, right? They're so far ahead of where we are. Mm-hmm. So like all the red that's coming up right now, this like sort of bright red that came up last season that's sort of transforming into these like more ox blood, deeper reds for the fall. Like, you know, our trend forecasting teams, they predicted that 2 years ago. But I think that there's something really true, Eden, about what you're saying, that trends keep coming and going. And so, like, is that actually a trend? I think, you know, it's a little bit of like yes and no, in my opinion, right? Because I do think that there are a lot of people out there that really can march to their own beat very comfortably, right? They don't need to follow a trend. They want to be here themselves. So like, they're not going to do cottage core or they're not going to do mob life. They're just going to mix and do whatever they want to do. Right. And they're privileged and they're lucky to be able to do that. But I also think that there are quite a lot of people who want to be confident, right. But they don't know how, right. And so that they do need some sort of guidance around what looks good or how to wear a wide leg jean or a trend like that. So I think the naming of some of these like fast trends, like, you know, the cottage core, the mob wife, mm-hmm. or even the quiet luxury, that stuff is, I feel like that stuff quickly cycles, right? Like you can come up with a new pithy phrase around, you know, what that means. And again, yeah, like I don't necessarily subscribe to that kind of trend. But what I do like about trends is that for the people who do want help, do want that, where style is not something that naturally comes innate to them, that through trends we can help, you know, less fashionable customers or less stylish people become more stylish, which inherently creates more confidence for them, right? So, you know, I think it's a little bit of yes and no. But I'm fascinated by trends because, again, going back to, you know, I think, Abby, what you were saying, what's happening in the cultural zeitgeist, like the sociology, the psychology of people and how they're intaking current affairs and the economy and politics and all the shit that's going on in the world, and how does that get projected out? Mm-hmm. Fashion is one of those places. Art is one of those places. Music is writing is one of those places, right? Where you start to feel like all of the beauty and the joy and the angst and all of what's happening as a world come out. And having a team of people that gets to look and start to ingest and digest that stuff is really fascinating. It's really cool.
What I would give to enter the trend forecasting room. Like, why do I imagine they're all around like a magic ball being like, in two years, green's going to come back in a big way.
I mean, it's kind of like that minus the magic ball. They spend a lot of times on their computers looking at pictures, right? But if you do walk by their screens, there are some cool looking pictures on there. They spend a lot of time reading though too, right? Because a lot of it is like, you know, what's happening in the music world or what's happening in with playwrights or books or novels. You know, it's there's so much politics. There's so much stuff that really you'd be surprised, like helps predict the color, the Pantone color of the year is going
to
be.
No, I mean, that's why we wanted to have you on, because fashion is so much a part of art.
It 1,000% is.
Yeah, whether that's the manifestation of the things that are happening in the world of art as a whole or as an art form itself, like, it's a language. And we're so glad to have you on to translate it for us.
Oh, no, I'm also here for the ride.
Well, we're glad to have you on no matter what. So I know we're probably going to be rounding out to the end of our time. So I just wanted to ask, a few like last questions.
Okay.
So we're rounding out the end of this episode. Olivia, thank you so, so much for having you on. You're like actually the coolest. I've been like shaking in my boots this entire time. So we'll end it with a silly question. What do you want to see more out of the world fashion-wise in the next year?
Ooh.
Is that a silly question or is that a serious question?
I don't know.
I guess I could have a silly response. I could have a silly response and I could have a serious response.
You can do two responses.
Okay. My serious response is I think fashion's a really, really, really hard business. I have so many friends that are so incredibly talented and so deserving, but they just can't make it happen, right? Like you pour so much money into samples and shows and models and imagery and all of that stuff. And the cycle of how fashion works, you know, retailer has to come in, place an order. 6 months later, you need to deliver, but you need to upfront pay for all of your production and sewing and packaging and shipping and hangers and all of that stuff. And then you have to hope that even the store that bought your clothes is going to pay you on time, let alone you start chasing for a paycheck and all of that stuff. The cycle is really messed up. And I think if there was a way in which we could be more supportive, right, to make businesses a viable business, that's something that I'd love more to see, right? How do we help emerging designers create viable businesses? That would be my serious answer. And then my silly answer is, you know, I just love to see more Comme des Garçons. Like, Comme des Garçons is like, Mary Kawakubo is my goddess. She is like my everything, everything, everything. She's super elusive. I've been privileged to have met her once at her Met Gala show. And she, you know, people were in like black tie affair and she was just still wearing a black skirt with a black leather jacket and sunglasses. She was just being her. But yeah, more Comme and more viable businesses.
Both good things.
If we had the rights to the song, this is where we'd end the episode by playing Rina Sawayama's song. Yeah, totally. But we don't have the rights, so just everyone imagine it.
Just hum it.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. We really appreciated having you here. I feel like my brain has increased by 3 sizes. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for thinking of me, seriously. Like, it's I'm so excited to be a part of this and really, really so impressed with what you guys are doing. Particularly as it's so like intercontinental, right? It's hard to coordinate. Eden, I can clearly see it is way late for you. So I appreciate you guys thinking of me and having me. It was so fun.
Again, just thank you so much. And I just wanted to add a little bit, something a little extra, just to say like, thank you so much for like, I guess like following your passions, following your dreams for yourself, but also because like the ability for other people to be able to look into an industry and see like someone who like looks like them, has similar backgrounds to them in a place where they think it's inaccessible to them. But then like seeing someone there, I feel like it just opens the door and people will be like, oh, I see someone there who represents me. Now I have the courage to also enter that space because now I know that I do belong there because someone's there who is me. So I just wanted to say thank you for that. And thank you for coming on this podcast to share your story with all the Asian youth out there who might want to enter the fashion industry, but are a little scared because they think that there's no space for them. So thank you for that.
Yeah, there's space. There's a lot of space. Thank you, guys.
And with that, season 7 has come to a close. Oh my God, what a fantastic episode to close out our season. And what an amazing season overall. It's been a joy to record these episodes and have the interviews that we've had, as well as the chatty episodes, which we are really glad you guys are equally enjoying. But yes, thank you guys so much for tuning into this episode and for tuning into this whole season. We'd really love it if you guys could leave us a review and let us know your favorite episode of the season, or feel free to comment on our Instagram and let us know. We love reading your comments. But yeah, until next season, which spoiler alert is amazing, we'll see you guys later. Bye.
As this episode comes to a close, we'd like to shout out the rest of our team who you don't hear from as often as us co-hosts. Their contributions are integral to the smooth running of Dear Asian Girl, and we would hate to take all the credit for what is truly a huge team effort.
Annika, May, Pavani, Yalda, Anya, and Michaela are our researchers, and Sonia is our audio engineer.
Emma, Prisha, and Claire are our social media writers. Chloe, Kaylee, and Nicole are our social media illustrators.
Alex is our social media manager, and Annette is our podcast manager.
And finally, Ellie is our podcast director. Thanks, team. We couldn't do it without you.